I started the recording.
Excellent. So, good morning, everyone. This is our April Journal Club. And I'm going to share my screen. Hey Anya, I don't see how I could share my screen. Is there?
Oh, there should be a green button. You should be able to do that.
Oh, here
on the bottom.
All right. Here we go. Can you see it now?
Coming, coming. Yes, we see it.
All right. So there were some interesting articles this month, and I selected five for presentation. Some of them are shorter to discuss, so hopefully we can finish it in 45 minutes. So the first article is from Sugiyama and colleagues from Yokohama, Japan. A distinctive cytomorphological feature of interstitial pneumonia-related lung adenocarcinoma, the potential issues and solutions in practical diagnosis from cancer cytopathology. Some background, the cytological features of interstitial pneumonia-related adenocarcinoma haven't been clearly described, as the authors put it. And just another piece of information, HNF4-alpha has been reported in invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma of the lung, and I believe we all know that. So the objective of the study was to describe cytomorphological features of interstitial pneumonia-related lung adenocarcinoma. The authors used bronchial brushing cytology samples from 40 interstitial pneumonia-related lung adenocarcinoma cases. This is called the IP group, and 110 control cases, namely lung adenocarcinoma cases that are unrelated to interstitial pneumonia. This is the non-IP group. All patients underwent surgery afterwards, and the histopathological subtypes of the tumors were determined. And the authors reviewed the cytological features and focused particularly on cytoplasmic mucin production. So here are the results. Neoplastic cells with cytoplasmic mucin were detected in 44% of cases in the IP group, and these cases turned out to be, or most of them turned out to be, invasive mucinous adenocarcinomas.
Can I ask a question, Andres? How did they define IP versus not IP?
So patients who had interstitial pneumonia.
Defined how?
Good question.
The only reason I ask is at one of the fellow case conferences at the ATS, there were three mucinous adenocarcinomas, all of which were reviewed by expert clinicians, including Marvin Schwartz, and all were called interstitial pneumonia before they knew they had cancer. So I'm just curious, how did they know they had interstitial pneumonia? Was it PFTs? Was it radiology? Was it a histologic diagnosis? And if so, what kind of IP did they have?
That's a good question, but I don't know the answer right away.
So they could have been selecting mucinous adenocarcinomas that looked like they had IP.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. I haven't thought about that. So I sort of accepted that the patient had the interstitial pneumonia, didn't dig into that.
Fair enough, thanks.
All right, so, and the authors also looked at the percentage of the equivocal and or negative cytology diagnoses. And in the IP group, this was 55%. And the non-IP group, it was about 42%. So the equivocal and negative diagnoses were significantly more in the IP group. And the reason it was, according to the authors, that the cytology diagnosis of invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma is difficult to diagnose due to mild nuclear ectopia. So because of this, they went back to HNF4-alpha using a cell transfer technique and looked at the immunohistochemical expression of this protein. And using that, four of the six equivocal cases in the IP group became positive retrospectively. So the authors concluded the cytological diagnosis of IP-related lung adenocarcinoma may be more difficult to diagnose because of the larger proportion of invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma, again, which has a lower degree of cytological ectopia. And they recommend immunohistochemistry for HNF for alpha to improve the diagnosis of IP-related lung adenocarcinoma. So, questions? Have you guys had this experience with interstitial pneumonia-related lung adenocarcinoma that the mucinous type is more common? Anyone?
I mean, I've often said that I think mucinous adenocarcinomas are more common in this group, but to be honest, I've never studied it systematically, but it just seems anecdotally like a fair number are mucinous. I don't know what percentage.
No, that's good information. And do you guys have HNF4-alpha in your list of...
If we do, I've never used it.
Okay. All right. And actually, I looked it up. It's in the WHO saying it's that it's non-specific. Not entirely specific.
Well, then it must be true.
Invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma. But it's listed as one of the immunostains that can be used.
But, and right. By not specific, they mean it stains other kinds of adenocarcinoma?
Other kinds of tumors, yes.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Thanks. All right. The next paper is from our good friends, Dr. Luka Brucic, and is the first author, and Francois Galatos-Salle is the corresponding author. It's about a combination of MTAP and P16 immunohistochemistry can substitute for CDKN2A FISH in diagnosis of and prognosis of pleural mesotheliomas. So it's a pretty straightforward paper. the background is that the homozygous deletion of CDKN2A is one of the most frequent genetic abnormalities in pleural mesotheliomas. So it can be used to distinguish benign mesothelial proliferations from malignant mesotheliomas. We don't say malignant anymore. So from mesotheliomas. So homozygous, as I just said, it's a reliable marker of malignancy in this setting. And the locus of CDKN2A includes, which is 9P21, includes MTAP in addition to CDKN2A. The letter is frequently co-deleted with CDKN2A due to its proximity. So the objective of the study was to examine the question of whether immunochemistry for MTAP and P16, which is a product of CDKN2A, can serve as a surrogate for CDKN2A homozygous deletion by FISH. So the authors randomly selected 125 pleural mesothelioma cases and divided them into through three groups. There were 53 cases with homozygous deletion, 39 cases with heterozygous deletion, and 33 cases without deletion. And they applied P16 and MTAP immunohistochemistry and CDKN2A FISH to these cases. On loss of P16 nuclear expression as defined as less than 1% staining showed a high sensitivity but low specificity for CDKN2A homozygous deletion by FISH. MTAP by itself, on the other hand, actually MTAP cytoplasmic expression loss defined as less than 30% staining showed a 97% specificity and 69% sensitivity for the same for the same deletion. So one test had high specificity, the other had high sensitivity, and when they combined the results of the two markers, then they got both high specificity with 96% and high sensitivity with 86%.
Hey, Andres, can I ask, in talking about specificity and sensitivity, the comparison is to FISH, not to metastatic adenocarcinoma.
That's correct. So
okay.
So they examined these three groups, So they compared the immunochemistry of MTAP, P16, and the combination of the two to CDKN2A loss by FISH. Deletion by FISH.
Thank you.
They also looked at the prognosis, and patients with retained P16 expression had the best prognosis, whereas patients with P16 and MTAP loss had the worst prognosis. And I believe this refers to the mesothelioma group. I mean, the overall group.
Was that independent of histology? So it didn't matter if that was an epithelioid, biphasic, or sarcomatoid? So was that better than histology in predicting prognosis?
Again, it's a good question. I don't know whether they broke it down to histology. I believe most cases were actually epithelioid, as you would expect. Okay. So, conclusions. MTAP immunohistochemical staining is a valid surrogate marker for CDKN2A homozygous deletion by FISH. However, to obtain the same accuracy as the FISH assay, a combination of nuclear P16 and cytoplasmic MTAP staining is recommended. And the findings correlate with the prognosis.
Andras, would you mind going back to your previous slide? Because I have a hard time wrapping my head around that. How the addition of P16 really adds anything. I mean, it has a low specificity. Are we saying then the sensitivity is higher? I don't understand that. If you put that together with something that which has already a high specificity.
As far as P16 is concerned, P16 has high sensitivity and MTAP has high specificity for the homozygous deletion of CDKN2A.
But let's say you have something that shows expression of MTAP but loss of P16. Given the low specificity of loss of P16, how valuable is that? I mean, with 43%, I would say it's almost 50-50 whether it's really malignant or not with loss of P16 expression.
At least
that's what I understand by that.
So, yeah, I mean, if you have only loss of only one of the markers, immunohistochemical markers, then either the low sensitivity, high sensitivity, low specificity scenario, or the high specificity, low sensitivity scenario applies.
But the surrogate is that it has to have both, right? And it's not either or. They achieve higher specificity and higher sensitivity when both are true, which does seem weird.
Is it possible they used BAP1 in here to...
They didn't look at BAP1 in this
part. Oh, they didn't. Yeah, I can't work it out otherwise. I wonder if BAP1 was used to provide the specificity.
It wasn't used.
Okay.
I mean, if both have to be lost, then I don't know what P16 really, how it adds anything to it. But apparently it does.
Well, it increases sensitivity to 86% from 69, and I can't see how it does that if the specificity stays the same, 96 and 97, or it goes down to 96. But I mean, that's within.
So basically, you have to see both to use it as a reliable marker. I guess if one is positive and the other is negative, then you probably need to do the FISH.
But then your specificity has gone down by 1% and your sensitivity has gone up, and I also can't understand it.
I'm
just saying if you use both of them, specificity stays high at 96 or 90, you know, the first one was 90 without P16, it's 97%.
I followed how the authors put it, and for P16, sensitivity comes first with 96%, and specificity follows with 43, and for MTAP, they actually quote the specificity first with 97, and the sensitivity follows with 69%.
But then with my simple brain, I'm just asking how, if something is specific and something is very non-specific, how can, are you saying that when you combine them,
right,
with MTAP positive and P16 positive, you get a better sensitivity, but you've already got MTAP in there because it's only positive in much less. So it just doesn't make sense just using those two.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely have that if you wish, but if you use a marker which is highly sensitive and another marker which is highly specific, then you definitely get some added benefits. Any other questions? All right. So then we are moving on. So the next one is actually consensus statement, but I thought it might be interesting to the group. So this is from Rahan and colleagues. There are two co-senior authors. One is from Canada, the other is one from UK, and this is the European Respiratory, from the European Respiratory Journal. The title of this consensus statement is Progressive Pulmonary Fibrosis, an Expert Group Consensus Statement. So this is a popular topic. There was a platform presentation about it at the OSCAP meeting. And the objective of this study is to provide expert guidance on the frequent management and monitoring uncertainties in fibrosing interstitial lung diseases other than idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, with a particular focus on fibrosing interstitial lung diseases that continue to progress despite initial management. It is stressed that the statement should not be viewed as a guideline. So actually, they divided this statement into four sections, and altogether these four sections have 24 questions, and I just selected a few questions that might be relevant to this group. So, and I believe I selected five questions. So question number one, what is the difference between fibrosing interstitial lung disease and a progressive fibrosing interstitial lung disease? So F, ILD versus PPF, I believe. FILD, fibrosing interstitial lung disease with the clinical, radiological, and physiological indicators of progression despite management instituted for the underlying fibrosing interstitial lung disease, leading to consideration of antifibrotic therapy, is best designated as PPF, progressive fibrotic interstitial lung disease. Shortly PPF, despite management. That's the difference between fibrosing interstitial lung disease and progressive fibrosing interstitial lung disease. And question number two, what are the underlying diagnoses of patients with FILDs? And there is a list which includes idiopathic and non-idiopathic fibrosing interstitial lung diseases. The idiopathic includes idiopathic non-specific interstitial pneumonia, cryptogenic organizing pneumonia with supervening fibrosis, idiopathic descamative interstitial pneumonia, and idiopathic lymphocytic interstitial pneumonia, which Harry and his paper would say non-existent. Non-idiopathic forms of fibrosing interstitial lung diseases in this category of progressive interstitial lung diseases include connective tissue disease, ILDs, fibrotic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, exposure-related ILDs, including asbestosis, etc., drug-induced ILDs, sarcoidosis, and anti-neutrophilic cytoplasmic autoantibody-associated vasculitis. And of course, also unclassifiable ILD. Question number three. Approximately what percentage of non-IPF interstitial lung diseases progress despite management, and are there any risk factors for progression or subsets that progress more often? And the panel quotes three studies, which include 473 patients. And based on these three studies, 18 to 32% of patients with non-IPF ILDs develop progressive pulmonary fibrosis within 61 to 18 months from the onset of symptoms. The key risk factor for progressive pulmonary fibrosis is a usual interstitial pneumonia pattern. So again, IPF is not included in the clinical category of progressive pulmonary fibrosis, but UIP pattern is. So if the patient has hypersensitivity pneumonia, then he or she would do worse if this fibrotic HP manifests as UIP. They also point out that each ILD subtype is associated with different risk or odds of progression. Therefore, an accurate knowledge of the initial diagnosis of the ILD subtype is important to enable risk stratification. Question number four, what is the importance of making an accurate initial FILD diagnosis? And this is similar to the previous question. An accurate initial diagnosis of fibrosing interstitial lung disease is of paramount importance to achieve accurate initial management, guide frequency and thoroughness of monitoring, and allow communication to the patient of the possible course of a particular ILD to prepare better for the future. And I believe this is the last question I included. This is question number 7. How does one define progression? And the answer is early recognition of progressive pulmonary fibrosis despite management is important, as there is insufficient evidence validating the use of anti-fibrotic therapy in fibrotic interstitial lung diseases at presentation. To answer the actual question is no one size fits all definition of progression exists. And then they also add that in the real world, various combinations of increasing respiratory symptoms, reductions in lung function, and diffusing capacity of the lung for carbon monoxide and or signs of increasing fibrosis on HRCT scan are used to identify progression. And I didn't include that question, but they point out that a progressive fibrosis doesn't necessarily correlate with acute exacerbations. So the two are not the same. Questions, comments?
It seems odd to exclude IPF because the presumption is that everybody progresses, but the truth is not everybody does. And I think that's one of the challenges with use of antifibrotics, which I get that the pulmonology community has embraced with enthusiasm for understandable reasons. But that's the problem patients face, right? Is knowing where they fit on that curve, which has a tail. It doesn't go to zero. Nobody's curve does. So it's weird to exclude that because not everybody with UIP-IPF ends up having a progressive pulmonary fibrosis phenotype based on any definition.
That's a good point. I guess at least histologically, the UIP pattern is more reliable predicts a prognosis in the currently defined group, and that would be inherently present in the IPF group. But
yeah, that's a really good point.
Thanks for commenting on that. I was just looking through some old images for putting a talk together, and I came across a case that kind of bounced back. You know, it's like 5 years later, and they want you to re-review the slides because you called it UIP, you know, likely IPF, and the patient's still doing fine. And you kind of look at the slides, you go, well, that's UIP. So, you know, I think there are patients like that. So thanks for, you know, kind of reiterating that. We tend to forget that, I think.
So yeah, I think we've all had that experience, Henry. And I think those experiences are really telling and important. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, I have an exact same case still going, and it would be UIP by any other, IPF by any other. Yeah.
So maybe UIP is not, as you pointed out, not a homogeneous group, and perhaps molecular understanding of IPF or UIP pattern would help us to understand the prognosis better. Any other questions, comments? All right, so we still have about 9 minutes, and these are two shorter articles. The first of the two is by Lin and colleagues, digital quantification of tumor cellularity as a novel prognostic feature of non-small cell lung carcinoma. And the corresponding author is from Ontario, Canada. the objective is to test the hypothesis that tumor cellularity can be used as a novel prognostic tool for lung cancer. So that in our AI era is actually something interesting. So as far as methods are concerned, digital slides from the Cancer Genome Atlas, lung adenocarcinoma data set, and lung squamous cell carcinoma data set were obtained and analyzed. The number of cells was normalized with the surface area of the tumor to provide a measure of tumor cell density. Tumor cellularity was calculated by multiplying the size of the tumor with the cell density. Major histologic patterns and grade were compared with the tumor density of the lung adenocarcinoma, lung squamous cell carcinoma cases. And the overall and progression-free survival were compared between the groups of high and low tumor cellularity. And the results show that high-grade histologic patterns in the adenocarcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma cases were associated with greater tumor densities compared with low-grade patterns. Cases with lower tumor cellularity had improved overall and progression-free survival compared with cases with higher cellularity. So the figures illustrate that the patients, the authors outlined the tumor, total cell detection image analysis was performed to detect tumorous and non-tumorous areas. Within the tumorous areas, this image analysis software detected the cells, actually both the tumorous and non-tumorous areas, but what's important is that the software detected cells and has cell density in the tumorous areas. And the results show that various adenocarcinoma subtypes, including lapidic, acinar, papillary, complex glandular, solid, and micropapillary patterns correlate with cell densities. The software didn't look at air spaces and the stroma, so the cell density is strictly applied to the cellular areas, including tumor cells. And the same is true for, the same was done for squamous cell carcinomas as well. The squamous cell carcinomas were stratified as well-differentiated, moderately differentiated, and poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinomas. And again, the more poorly differentiated tumors showed higher cell densities. So the authors concluded that the results support tumor cellularity as a novel prognostic tool for non-small cell lung carcinoma. It's actually some sort of combination of both grade and stage, because this method seems to replace or at least mimic various tumor subtypes which correlate with tumor grade as far as adenocarcinoma is concerned, in the same force claim. And also, it also includes some staging because actually they look at tumor, they also calculate the tumor density for the entire tumor. Questions?
Yeah, so Andres, did they look at, were these, because these are from an online set, was the whole tumor put through for histology? And did they examine the whole tumor? You know, because cellularity can be very variable.
I believe so. So they looked at the entire tumor.
Okay, and they only did an H&E? They didn't do immunohistochemistry to help them differentiate the cells?
I believe not.
Yeah. Just with my experience trying to segment cells, it's incredibly difficult using software to do this. Just based on an H&E, I think would be even more difficult. I just wonder what their repeatability, reliability was with this software.
I cannot answer.
Yeah, I don't think they had that data in there, actually.
Yeah. Any other questions, comments? If no, then we are going to have 2 minutes to look at the last paper. Prognostic impact of tumor budding in squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. This has been done for other tumor organ types. Apparently, tumor budding is defined as the presence of isolated single cancer cells or clusters up to 4 cancer cells at the invasive tumor front. The purpose of this study was to investigate this feature in lung squamous cell carcinoma. And this is a systematic review and meta-analysis. And they found 243 studies, and they thought that 9 were relevant, comprising 2,546 patients. The results showed that an increased risk of death and recurrence was evident in patients with high-grade tumor budding, pathological stage 2, lymph node metastasis, lymphovascular, and the pleural invasion were also associated with high-grade tumor budding. So it looks like it might be a promising prognostic factor, but the authors also point out that the publications including some bias, therefore further studies are needed. So it's 11 o'clock. Any questions? Comments? If not, then thank you for listening.
Thank you, Andres.
Thank you, Andres.
Thank you.
Good day.
You too.
Thank you.